I'm Lily.
I'm Lorraine.
And we're caffeinated on the train.
Welcome back, dear listener. We recorded our last episode mere moments ago.
But we're about to do it all again.
We're powering through.
Dedication.
And this is an exciting episode because in this episode we're going to talk about lots and lots of things that we have done.
Yeah, various, numerous.
Many a thing.
Yeah.
But we're going to start with some things that we have done
recently.
Yes, like in the amount of time since we last
met to record.
Exactly. Not counting the episode we recorded mere moments ago.
No, no. Of course not.
Blown the whole cover. Start over.
Bleep all that out. So what is your thing? What have you done?
I recently had a very interesting experience of giving a colloquium presentation about my master's thesis.
Yeah, I remember we met about this. What were some of your concerns going in? How did it go in the end?
Well, it was... I consider myself very good at giving presentations.
Yeah, you are very good at giving presentations.
And I really like giving presentations.
I hope that you guys get the privilege to see her give a presentation because it's very, it's very good.
I like having lots of interactive activities.
She does. She makes you do exercises. And, you know, you're there for it. She makes you want to do the exercises.
So normally, like, I don't even know when the last time is that I felt anxious about giving a presentation, including the presentation I gave in Prague where I had lost my laptop just before.
Yeah. You weren't anxious for that? You must have been a little bit anxious.
I was anxious about my laptop, but I wasn't anxious about the presentation.
Nice.
But this colloquium presentation, I felt really quite stressed about.
Yeah, I remember you were a bit nervous about it.
Yeah, quite a bit nervous. And the reason is that it's not often that I feel I share my work publicly when my work is in a state of kind of partial completion.
Right.
I really love talking about my work with other people. In fact, I have basically a whole podcast dedicated to it.
It's true. Yeah, several hours.
Many hours, not counting all the hours that you can get for free just by hanging out with me. Also, the podcast
it's basically
is free.
Just this and, sign up for our Patreon.
Right. To pay to hear more.
But pay to be your friend, basically.
Basically. I feel that I talk with people a lot about my research when it's in kind of like the larval stages.
Yeah.
When I've just sort of gotten my teeth into a topic and I have a lot of opinions about it and I'm kind of just
interested in it. Yeah.
Just tossing them around. I talk a lot then. And then I talk a lot with people when I feel like I'm almost done.
Right.
And that's actually when I would recommend talking with people the most, when you feel like you've done all the work.
Yeah, I very much agree with that.
Because that's the point when people will be adding new things.
Mm.
And so my line of thinking has always kind of been like, well, if I know I'm only half done, why would I share it with other people? Because they're just going to tell me to do things that I already planned to do and just haven't quite gotten around to yet. But this is the situation with a master thesis colloquium for a project that's not finished, is that I'm sharing work that's not finished. And that was like weird and freaky to me.
Yeah.
But the experience was great.
Wow, maybe that's gonna open up new... Because, you know, it makes me think in this lecture series that I'm in, actually, sometimes I realize that they have people present, because they probably need people to present, but like that have a research project that they are still very much in the middle of, or even maybe towards the beginning, but not in the larval stages anymore. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've done some cases where they have researched well enough to give an hour and a half presentation on it, but they're still not really sure what they want to do with it or what the end result will be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe that will open up new space and a new level of confidence for doing the same in a given context if one should arise, that an opportunity would arise to do so.
I think so. And I think this is actually something that I want to work on as a way of fostering more intellectual collaboration in
my
life.
Yeah.
And definitely. So I have some plans to go to conferences and talk about things that I'm not 100% on and have that be sort of part of the presentation is to ask for feedback in this sort of halfway there stage.
I think that takes a lot of strength and confidence and level. It's from the exercises that you're doing. It takes a level, though, of confidence, and I think it's like another level of being able to give a presentation, actually, is to be able to do so within that stage. And that's inspiring to me because I'm also going to a conference, and it makes me think, if it's not all the way done, I can just pull a Lorraine.
You can. Although I think usually pulling a Lorraine involves doing the whole thing the night before.
Right, of course. The morning of.
Frankly. The morning of.
During, I'm Googling, during.
No, the morning of, so that you finish off and you dust off your hands and then you walk into the first presentation.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Caffeinated.
Probably
like, kind of sweaty.
Probably.
Maybe a little bit out of breath.
Also, you might be on a train.
Yeah, it's true. I really might be on a train.
Where's the conference that you're...
I see what you're doing there. It's at Oxford.
Well, that's also perfect because I'm pretty sure that they have a lot of places where you can write something the morning of.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure. I think that's kind of their
whole
model.
Vibe. That's like their, that's, yeah.
I follow a lot of people on like social media who go to universities and like post about studying.
Mm-hmm.
And I follow this one channel of a girl who goes to Oxford who I can link. I'm forgetting her name right now. Whoops. But I can link it. And she posts vlogs of her doing essays for Oxford, and it's incredible Lorraine vibes. She does them so fast.
Wow.
Morning of.
Wow. I don't relate to doing things that way, but that's good for her that she's living her best Oxford life writing papers the morning of.
Yeah, so you know, if you get to the conference in Oxford and you haven't written
anything, because I'm going to be in Buenos Aires, like,
you're going to fit right in.
I'll fit right in, yeah. All right, it's good to know it's the kind of canter that they're up for at that prestigious university is me waltzing in, morning of, made this PowerPoint. Good to know.
Hey, if you have a good PowerPoint template.
Yeah. It doesn't really matter what's written on there.
Truly.
Honestly, less writing on the PowerPoint, better. More pictures.
Better template, less writing.
Yeah, actually, that's true.
That's
real advice. Like, you're getting free advice right now.
Mm-hmm.
Sign up for Lorraine's 10-day thesis writing.
I could have another, like, a 3-hour conference presentation.
You simulate like a high pressure situation.
Yeah.
If you don't do it, there's like corporal punishment involved. People are terrified, like trying to make their presentation. You have whips, sexy dictator costumes,
a range of torture devices.
Just waiting. Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah, that's. You're gonna, by the end, you're gonna be amazing at giving presentations.
You're gonna kill those presentations.
Yeah, or else be killed.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but
you're gonna be fearing for your life.
Definitely.
At times.
At many a time.
But that's the best way to learn. That's how you learn. Is, you know, it's memorable.
It's definitely memorable.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing this week, Lily?
Well, it was not quite 1 week ago, but I had. The morning, if you remember, dear listener, from the last episode, I mentioned that I had this very stressful, highly anticipated Spanish exam. And the momentous day which I got my results for the exam prior to when I went to get them, I had a job interview, which was preceded also by the fact that there was a pretty substantial leak in my ceiling. So that's how this day started. I was getting ready, preparing for this job interview for a teaching assistant position in sociology in the institute where I study, with a professor that I quite like and that I tend to really align with and our kind of views, and that's nice. But anyway, stressful morning, chaotic morning involving me emailing my landlord, her emailing me back saying, well, I'm out the door on the way, already late for my interview, out rushing out, emailing me saying I need to tell my neighbor or ask them what they're doing upstairs because, of course, logic dictates that they will tell me whatever it is if they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing because my landlord told me to. No, it's just not how the world works. Anyway, and also getting a call from her in the U-Bahn, surrounded on rush hour, by Germans trying frantically to explain with my extremely limited vocabulary about the fact that there's a ceiling, my ceiling's leaking and I'm on my way to my job interview. I can't talk right now. I did a bad job. She turned to English, which I wish she had just done from the beginning, to be honest.
Yes, that seems unfair.
I have a lot of language exam anxieties, and this felt like it might as well have been a language exam.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I digress. Got to the job interview, burst in the door, very out of breath, chaotic, wild eyes, looking around, crazy eyes. He's sitting there like, what's wrong with her? I explained, everything was fine. I didn't think the job interview went so well, but I did my best under the circumstances. I wasn't exactly in the headspace to give what I thought were probably the best answers to the interview questions, but I got the job. After applying to like a number of jobs in the John F. Kennedy Institute, which like, come on, there are like part-time student assistant jobs doing admin work.
That you are radically overqualified
thank
for.
Thank you. What was rejected from? And I was a bit frustrated. I kind of had given up. I'm a believer in sending out job applications and emails, and all this kind of thing whenever the chance arises, just because it's good practice, whether or not anything comes from it. And I recommend doing the same. But anyway, I got the job. I'm really excited about it, actually, because I'm working with this professor that I feel I align and jive well with in terms of things that we believe are the kind of standpoint that we have on a lot of issues, and that's exciting to me. And it also feels good to know that that's, I'm sure, also factored in the fact that I've had multiple classes with him and that he probably sees the same in me and that he would want someone to be his TA that, you know, thinks similarly to him. Mm-hmm. Or so I feel really good about that, and it's more validating than getting a student assistant job in the end. And I really can't wait to get teaching experience and to work as a TA, because I'm very passionate about sociology, and it's exciting to do that and to work in that way. And it's just like a good thing to build my kind of repertoire of experiences and my profile as I continue to move forward, and also to actually get the skills, not just for the line on the CV, but also because I'm actually would like to teach, and we've talked about this in previous episodes.
Yes, we've talked about how important teaching is as a feature of academia, and how important it is that graduate students get
teaching experience.
Yes, exactly.
So, and I actually brought that up on my interview.
Wonderful.
So it worked out. I think it was, we recorded that episode the night before, and I actually said I had a podcast.
That's why you got the job.
Yeah. You know, the right people will appreciate that sort of thing.
If they don't appreciate that you have a podcast, then you don't want to work for them anyway.
Disgusted.
I think when I had an interview for my current job, I also brought up that I had a podcast, but it was in the response to the question, do you have any hobbies?
I have a podcast.
About studying.
About studying. Yeah, that's the classic Lorraine. Like,
yeah.
Do I have any other hobbies that are not directly? But, you know, this is all leading towards an important point, which is today's episode.
In an unusual, uncharacteristically good transition.
Yeah, uncharacteristically.
In today's episode, we're going to be talking about para-academic activities.
And if you didn't realize, Newsflash just gave you an example of one of them, which is working as a TA, but also Lorraine's para-academic hobbies, would you call it? Is that what you would call hobbies for you? Is
yes.
yeah. It's like that one meme where it's the butterfly and he's like, is this a hobby?
Oh, that's too real. I'm going to put it on the Instagram.
Yeah, that goes on the account. That goes on the gram. So something that I think a lot of people really don't know or don't realize or necessarily think about, which I understand, because I think like the workload of being in a master's program can be heavy, and it can be easy to get lost in that and not to think about how can I, depending on what you want to do with your master's degree, but if you do want to potentially pursue any kind of future academic career, it's definitely important that you're, engaging in things outside of just your studies. It's actually probably more important that you're using the fact that you're in this university environment to find those other things more than your, like, raw studies of, like, doing your readings every week or, getting even a good grade on something.
Lily just did finger quotes.
It's important that you know that. So yeah, I mean, and you know, I also want to emphasize, like, things are good for your CV, but I think that for both of us, our interest in these para-academic activities is deeper than just a line on a CV. It's nice to have that because I think we both see our CVs as this, like, deeper kind of, like, profile of, like, who we are in a way.
Exactly.
And it's enjoyable to look at it that way. And on that note, I remember, and I think we've talked about this in a previous episode, but, like, when I was kind of coming up with my CV and starting to engage, I think Lorraine was a really good, gave really good advice about how, as someone who, in this case, I came to learn being like, I have so much going on already, like just with my usual class assignments, like how do you do all this extra stuff? Like, how do you manage all of that? And like, how can I do that? And I think you gave really good advice. Do you remember what the advice was? Not a clue. But the advice was, how can you use the work that you're already doing towards kind of reaching out and expanding your profile as a potential applicant in the future, and use that stuff to put lines on your CV, and also to just make that work do work for you, to get involved in other projects, and again, not just things that are aligned on a CV, but that you might actually already be interested in, such as...
Gosh, that was brilliant of me.
Classic.
Wow. I don't know. I don't quite want to get into the such as yet. I hope that's okay. Because first, I want to make a little clear to the listeners what exactly we and I mean when we use the phrase para-academic. And what I would describe this as is, first off, anything to do with academia that's not your classwork, but also potentially like the more important definition that I would want to give is kinds of work that relate to academia that teach you skills other than how to do research.
Like, would you call this a hobby? I'm just kidding.
Is this a hobby?
Is this a hobby?
I think this is what hobbies are.
Yeah, but in the sense that, yeah, like they're kind of honing other skills.
Exactly. So teaching is a really good and important example. And I think probably everyone should have some para-academic experiences that give you teaching skills. / public speaking skills, for example, going to conferences, which are great because those do hone your research skills.
Also, and your writing skills.
And your writing skills, but they also in a way,
speaking skills.
Give you teaching skills. Some other work that I feel like is para-academic in the best way because it makes use of a set of skills that I totally would not use if I wasn't doing this work, but that are actually important and also quite marketable skills, I think, is the work that I do for the conference network Progressive Connections.
Mm-hmm.
I am in charge of all their advertising and social media. And it may shock you, dear listener, but English students don't necessarily do a lot of advertising.
No.
In fact, I dare say, if there is one thing that English students don't do, it's try to sell you things.
And how do you feel that these skills translate into your kind of broader profile and goals? Like, what do you think you're learning from doing it?
I think I'm learning a lot about how to connect with people.
Mm.
Connections is right in the name. I think that I'm developing skills of telling people what they need to hear in order for me to get some kind of results, like, for example, them to come to one of our conferences.
World domination.
That's also one of them. And this, I mean, it's a good skill if you ever want to pivot out of academia. But
you might, like, I mean, I'm not saying you, but like,
but actually, one I think one of the things that's really important to me is if I reach a point in my life where I can't have an academic career for whatever reason, like, for example, that there are none, I don't want to then feel like all the work I've done has gone to waste,
yeah,
or like I have a 10-year gap on my CV. I want to feel like, okay, I can't be a professor, but I can do all of these other almost as cool things.
Yeah.
And so having transferable skills that aren't just research is really important for that. But then also, as an academic, spoiler, I'm going to need to advertise for things, like, for example, myself, for a job.
Yeah, and that's, again, why I think it's really important to just do interviews and apply for jobs, because every time you do it, like every time that I'm doing that, I'm sure I'm getting better and better, and asking always for feedback. Honestly, they need to be better at giving feedback. These people, these people offering jobs for low pay and not enough hours. However, I do think I actually primarily look at it that way as well, because I'm building skills that are really important, whether in academia or outside of academia.
I was actually just last night having a conversation with my mother about this very topic. And my mother is a very high-powered career
woman.
What's
her sign?
Leo.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
My mom is a Leo, too.
Ah, all the great moms.
Yeah.
All the moms of great people, also.
Yeah.
Us. I think I learned a lot from her in terms of advocating for yourself and putting yourself out there. And she was saying something that she has read, which I think I've also read, and in fact maybe we've even talked about it because it seems like a very us thing to talk about, is that men will apply for jobs if they have like 40% of the qualifications, and women on average don't apply for jobs until they have like all of
more
them,
of them.
Like 100%. And the other way to sort of like articulate this is that it's the job of the person who's looking for an applicant to decide who's qualified. It's not our job as the applicant to weed ourselves out because we think we're not qualified.
Yeah, that's nice. And I feel like I lost what I was gonna say to that. But I mean, I think I've even, actually, this is what I was going to say. And I also, maybe because I worked as a freelance writer before this, I think I've really, and this is surprising for me in terms of like how my Virgo rising, how like fraught I can be about outcomes or grades, for example, that's like deeply ingrained in my American childhood self. And perfectionism and all this. But I think I've really, a long time ago, and I think because of freelancing and because this is the nature of that work, detached myself very well from like the result of a job interview or application. Like, I don't give a fuck, to be honest. A lot of times, there's jobs I apply for that I want, but I would say the majority of jobs that I apply for, I don't necessarily want them, and I don't really care if I get them. But I mean, you know, I mean, sometimes I'm a little bit like eye roll. What more do they want from me? Like, I send you those messages kind of often, but that's, you know, but the point is like that, I think I really have kind of isolated it to more focusing on the process of writing cover letters, preparing an application, doing an interview, and that this is almost actually more of what it is for me. And like, I know a lot of people who get really, they apply to very few jobs, and they hold like very high stakes on what they apply for, and then they get really like hurt and discouraged from applying for more jobs in the future if they don't get that job. But yeah, I think I have like a pretty acute sense of things that we've talked about, how many times, especially in the academic context where we study, that applying for jobs, like, there's just always factors that are way outside of your control of why you didn't get a job if you didn't get a job. And I think that's really important to remember. It's really, to me, it's how I try to look at dating and being rejected in the dating pool, is like, there are reasons that you may never be able to know, and you have to hold on to that fact as you just fling yourself at jobs, potential romantic partners. I mean, maybe not so much. More jobs here. I'm not more interested in related jobs. But it's a similar, the rejection, the feeling of rejection is similar, that like, and when I refer to the specific academic context, I mean that oftentimes jobs are advertised as a formality and a procedural requirement, even though they already have a candidate that they are going to choose. And I've actually been chosen for one of those jobs, and it's silly on both sides. Because it, yeah, but
total waste of everyone's
that's
time.
Yeah, that's a whole other side tangent, but that that you can't really like become too attached to the outcome of a job interview, and that you should practice maybe also doing this practice of just applying for things for the sake of doing the practice of doing so, because then that way when you do want a job, you will already be like much more qualified just by how well you're able to present yourself from practicing it so many times.
Mm-hmm. And a wonderful thing about that as well is that the more things you apply to, the more opportunities you're going to have.
Precisely. And then you just kind of see where the chips fall. And in fact, also, like, I know a lot of people in their early 20s. I'm now in my mid-20s, so I can offer you early 20-year-olds some advice, which is if you're feeling a bit like lost in your life, you're not sure what you want to do, just apply and try everything. Don't worry about falling on your face. Like, don't worry about getting rejected. Just send applications. Just go to events. Just like throw your hand, your hat into as many rings as you can find and see what sticks. And I think the same applies here. And I think it's, you have so much more to gain from doing that than you have to lose by being maybe rejected by something that possibly wasn't meant for you anyway.
Absolutely.
So I guess one of my para-academic activities is also, I'm just realizing right now, this just applying for a lot of stuff. And I think that, again, like, we need to normalize getting rejected. And I think no matter who you are, you're going to experience a lot of rejection. And it's important also just to learn to cope with that. It's important to, build these kinds of skills in general.
Yes.
But that's not really, like, my most exciting. I mean, when I was thinking of, I think that you have, like, a more, like, also fun and creative para-academic activity kind of realm. And I also will say that, like, something for myself in terms of how I'm preparing for not necessarily being, as we're saying, like, there might not be academic jobs. I'm actually planning on that more and more in terms of the future. But something that I'm kind of aspiring to is being, like, a traveling free radical academic where,
radical?
Just, yeah. I know what I said. someone that, like, is able to have the qualifications to write and potentially, like, live on grants and write books and other media and work in this light. I have a friend, a girl that I met at a conference also, who went to Harvard to get her PhD at Harvard, and also, FYI, struggling to find an academic teaching job, a professorship. And she is doing that right now. She, like, lives in Paris and is translating her book on a grant. So I was like, that's pretty
not bad.
Yeah, not bad. Like, that also sounds nice. Like, she seems like she's doing it. She has a nice setup going. So I'm fine with that. But one of my things is kind of more in the intercultural. I mean, I also have, like, some freelance background, but also in the more kind of, like, intercultural and getting experiences living and working and studying and doing research in different like contexts. So not only obviously that we're studying in Germany, but an ongoing project I have is studying and improving my Spanish. And I'm currently, one of my main things I'm doing right now is this long application process to study in Mexico. And this semester break, I'm also organizing some pretty informal, but research in Buenos Aires, doing participant observation and interviews for a paper or conference presentation project that I'm working on. So those are two of my main things, but they all kind of fit in this realm of, like, this is my other kind of side passion that I am trying to develop, and I think will coincide with my future endeavors and work as well. So what Lorraine would call a hobby. and in terms of, I just, one last thing on the, so I'm doing this kind of research, this independent research in Buenos Aires, but in terms of this project to study in Mexico City, something that's been interesting in terms of how it differs, or the way that it's much more involved, I think, than, like, applying to study abroad in an undergrad, at least in the North American, I don't know how it is to do that here in Europe, but in Erasmus or something, but within the States, when you want to study abroad in a bachelor's program, the idea, I think, is more just, like, for the sake of going to another country is enough. It's kind of just, I mean, it's, you don't need to argue that that's, like, a nice thing to be able to do, mm-hmm. and, like, universities offer it. And that's kind of the end of it. Like, they have their infrastructure set up, done. But what I found that in this point in my academic career, I need to justify why at this point in my academic career this is something that I need to be doing, and I need to substantiate why, or specifically what it is, and then also what qualifies me mm-hmm. previously in my actual work and career and like skill set to do that. And I think that that's definitely something that's been different. It's no longer enough to, but it feels much more professional because it's really me having to substantiate, like, what about this specific place and this specific program at a specific university, which resources at that university do I need to carry out this research question that I have? What research experience have I done in the past? And how have all these different things I've engaged in so far in my coursework been also to carry out a specific research question or project? So that's been a good exercise also in the vein of applying for things and learning how to present myself as an applicant. I would say the writing a letter of motivation in itself is an art form.
Boy, is it ever.
That I have less experience in than writing a cover letter. But again, I think even the practice of doing these kinds of processes in themselves are really worthwhile, even despite the outcome in the end. And that kind of persistence that it requires, because man, I'll tell you, there have been many steps, more steps to come. I got an email saying I have another interview in Spanish that I have to do, and you already heard in the previous episode, but what's gonna be next? What's next? You know, what's
interpretive dance?
Yeah, it's all been waiting for that.
Yes.
All of our hobbies are actually just interpretive dance.
And designing the Two Women Show.
Yeah, I mean, everything that we've been saying have just been euphemisms for the Two Women Show. All these interviews. What do you think I'm doing in those interviews? But dancing and performing the Two Women Show.
Obviously.
I've said enough. I've alluded to it, but what are your more... Your kind of side hustle. It's not really a side hustle, but...
No, that implies I make money.
Yeah. Crucially, no.
I do not. I would say that I have a fairly robust side set of projects that are para-academic only because I'm a literature student.
Yeah.
Which is that I am fairly involved in creative writing projects. And... You may not know this, dear listener. Lily did not until I told her right before we started recording this episode. But right up until the moment I decided to be an academic, I planned to be a novelist. And I have, in fact, written several novels. Like, many, many a novel and many a,
amazing.
Many a short story.
Amazing.
Which are all saved on a disk drive somewhere. For future
Patreons, yeah.
Ooh. Ooh.
You're gonna be paying a lot for
you
that.
Pay a lot to get access to the complete works of Lorraine. Like an ungodly. The only person who can afford this is Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, if you're listening.
Give us all of your money. Destabilize your entire empire for the life works of Lorraine.
It's worth it, I can tell you. And so... Throughout the part of my life that is now me with the plan of being an academic, I've tried to keep connected to that. And the main way that that manifests is in my position as co-editor-in-chief of the FU Review Literary Journal, which at the time of recording, but probably not the time of posting, is accepting submissions for our 8th issue.
And she's doing a great job. Like, we've seen this... journal grow since she's been editor-in-chief.
Well, I can take only a fraction of the credit. I'm working with an amazing co-editor-in-chief and a really amazing board of people.
That's nice. That humility.
Thank you. I'm very proud of my humility.
I
like that because I feel like keeping in the literature producing world is very healthy for my ability to analyze literature.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Why?
In fact, I think that probably many literature scholars would be much better if they occasionally reached out into the publishing industry. Because it, for one thing, it gives me the freedom to do things like evaluate whether a work is bad.
Yeah, that's important. Turns out that's an important skill.
Turns out. Sometimes no one can tell if a work is bad, and then something really terrible might win the Booker Prize in 2014. Who can
Tragedy.
Say? And it also reminds me of the practical factors in what gets published, which is very important for me as a criticizer of canonized literature.
Yeah, wow, I really like how you're incorporating these two things, two hemispheres of...
It's very important to me to have this outside perspective.
Yeah, I think it's in general important to have outside perspectives.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I also, occasionally have poetry published. I just very recently got the acceptance for a kind of creative fictocritical question mark essay I wrote about porn. It's para-academic to a literature student.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I also want to throw in a shout-out for people who are listening to this, that for me, it's really, really important. I think that there are different ways to approach or engage in academia, but for me, it's really important that I keep at my academic pursuits compartmentalized and that I'm engaging in things also that at least seemingly have nothing to do with my academic work, and that everybody's different, and, you know, I can't speak for everybody, but I also want to normalize that because I think that especially the further you go in academia, there's more and more pressure to, like, have it consume you, or if you're not doing that, then you're not worthy or you're not dedicated enough. I think that that's a big thing, that there's a sign of your dedication.
Mm-hmm.
When in actuality, I'm someone that is just much more balanced and much more creatively inspired, and all of that feeds back into my ability to do my best work, and that I actually become really just more fraught and tense and less able to stay creatively stimulated personally in my academic work when I'm not completely disengaging and doing other things and having other activities, other things that bring me enrichment and joy and inspiration. And I want to just say that that's also very much, like, viable, that you're not dedicated or good enough if you just turn off that whole aspect of your life sometimes, and that that's only, a portion of the person that you are. So that's my...
I think that's really interesting because on the surface of it, it looks like we're quite different in that way.
Yeah.
Because I have this sort of, like, what's a hobby?
Yeah.
And, like, genuinely, there aren't a ton of things I like to do that aren't connected to my academic pursuit. But at the same time, I think a lot of the things I do are connected in a very unstructured way.
Yeah, that's nice. And I also think you have this kind of more hedonistic potentially. And I think some of the things that I'm engaged in academia, not that you aren't, like, I don't want to be presumptuous here, but are... maybe really can be really, like, difficult for me because they're sometimes, like, very, not to say that you don't engage in heavy things, but I think for me personally that my way of, like, being able to engage in certain, like, really difficult, uncomfortable topics is that, like, I also really, like, I have a need for, like, this sort of deeper connection that I think drives my, especially as, like, this humanism,
mm-hmm.
that drives the types of way that I engage in academia that's, like, more spiritual or more something else than just in the pleasure of doing the work. I don't think I get the same kind of pleasure out of doing my academic work, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's, like, the way to articulate this. In itself, I don't really get as much pleasure out of it. It's more that, like, this need, but for me, that I have to say something that I think for me to be connected with what that need is, it's like I need to be connected with, like, this other kind of profound engagement with life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I will say it.
Yeah, and I think the really important thing there is to just be regularly checking in with yourself and being like, am I happy with where the boundary is right
now? Yeah.
And that the place where the boundary is definitely going to change over time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the most important thing is that you feel good about where it's landing.
Yeah, I think that that's a very well said, because I think that is exactly what it is for me. And sometimes I have to step back and be like, wow, I really needed to put the boundary maybe sooner because I'm losing my kind of sense of balance.
Yeah. And I do also definitely think I have a tendency to move towards, one might say, less relevant research. I did scare quotes around relevant.
It's important that you know that.
If you've ever heard me do scare quotes and seen me in real life, you know that when I do scare quotes, I say things in a very specific way.
It's true.
And so you should be able to auditorily.
Yeah.
And I, in fact, while I'm currently trying, I'm making an effort to occasionally engage in topics that are harder or more relevant. It is always my impulse to move towards things that are just for fun.
Yeah, but you know, I appreciate that about you. I feel like it's taught me a lot to see how you are in that way, because as I say, I feel like I have this more almost like solemn relationship with work, and like my, that sometimes is not healthy. Sometimes it comes, as I say, from this like need to express certain things, but also sometimes I think it comes from this preoccupation I can have with perfectionism or needing certain validation through doing a good job on things that isn't really towards any like substantive end but that. So it's interesting, and it's been it's taught me a lot to get to know you and to have these conversations. And I think that's also what we're trying to do in this podcast, is to demystify more like people's relationship with work or their process around work or what it even means to work or to be in academia at all.
I think, again, really the key thing is that this is something you always have to be checking in with yourself about.
Yeah. And I think for me, I remember in high school, maybe I mentioned this before and some, I think I've told you it, but I don't know if it's been said on the podcast. In high school, our, we got to choose who gave our commencement speech, and we chose, of course, the literature teacher. I don't know, our favorite literature teacher of the class. And she talked to us about how we always need to make space in our life, no matter where we get or how busy we get, for something that she called soul time. And I really love that, and I feel that, and I practice that now. Like, for me, a lot of it is really just being by myself, whether it's just being home and like canceling, not doing anything but spending time with myself and whatever that means, whether it's just listening to music and reflecting or writing or reading or doing nothing. But it's different than I think just being lazy or mindless. It's like, it's really nourishing time that's helping me again connect with this deeper sense of like who I am or what my meaning is or how I'm engaging with the world. And academia for me needs to like be just an extension of this deeper thing that has to, for me, be at the center. And I think it can take many forms, but I really like this idea, and I think for everybody it's different, but soul time.
I really love that. That's something that I'm working on implementing and figuring out what that would look like for me.
Yeah, because I think it really is something that's different for everybody. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's nice because it really is different from, I don't know, just any form of leisure time.
Definitely. I sometimes talk about like high impact and low impact relaxation, which I think is, it's a similar kind of concept. It's like, will this relaxation bring up my levels of happiness?
And like resilience, exactly, to like deal with everything else.
Just feeling of goodness in the world.
Yeah, and just like, why else am I alive but for that, really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's very, very important. And I'm always, as someone who has pretty leftist values, I'm always a believer in doing things that don't necessarily have this, like, productive, specific outcome that you can quantify. Of course, it feels satisfying, again, as we've talked about, when you have control over what that is and you've set that meaning in the benchmark yourself rather than being part of this, like, corporate kind of productivity machine. But at the same time, I think it's also good to just do things because they connect with your kind of deeper why, as we've said before. So that's maybe not para-academic, but also important as a side note. But hopefully your para-academic activities are also giving you joy and not feeling like yet another thing. But it sounds like, I think in both of our cases, they are ways that we are translating things that we are passionate about into skills or whatever else, experiences. Or
I think one of the really great things about working this way is that if you're looking outside of the classroom or outside of the university structure for ways to engage with your research or your interests, you have a lot more opportunities for that engagement to be something that is also nourishing.
Yeah, and it's a good antidote against burnout. Mm-hmm. It's good to keep variety and...
And also, these often are things that can connect you to other people.
Yeah, very, very true. And other, yeah, other spaces and experiences, whether it's conferences or studying or spending time at different universities or working with advertising conferences or on a editorial board, mm-hmm. hosting launches of journals.
As I've said, the people I work with on the FU Review are just fantastic. They're a fantastic group. And I also want to say the people I work with at Progressive Connections are a fantastic group and have actually been really instrumental lately when I was going through a hard time with some of my quote-unquote real-life responsibilities. Mm. Having this as a quote-unquote job
that... I got the quotes. Mm-hmm. I like all the quotes that are happening
right quote, now. Quote, 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 quote.
Anyway, continue.
Having this as a sort of job that's not what my technical job is, mm-hmm. gave it the opportunity to be really nourishing and restorative.
That's really nice. And I also want to point out, I think it's extremely important that in terms of the other connecting with other people, mm-hmm. that you're seeking out like supportive networks of colleagues, and that is a factor that I've had to learn the hard way in other contexts, but like that the type of people that you're working with, how those people make you feel right from the beginning too, like I think that you are worth putting that as a priority. And I think again in academia it's really easy to fall into like exploitive relationships or relationships where you're not being treated with like the value that you deserve. And I think one way is to recognize and draw a line in the sand that's something that you expect from the team that you're contributing to. So mm-hmm. I think this is a really good example
yeah.
of how that can play out and be generative.
And it can be really scary to draw that line in the sand.
Definitely.
I think especially for career paths that are as competitive as academia. Yeah. And one of the ways to mitigate that feeling of fear that if you don't get this job, there's never going to be another job like it, is to have a diverse portfolio of skills.
Brilliant. Para-academic skills, hobbies.
Hobbies. But like that you can put on a CV.
Yes.
So that you can feel confident saying, even if I don't get this academic job, there are actually a lot of jobs out there that I can do and that I'm qualified to do in whatever way that qualification takes shape. And that I would love to do almost as much, if not just as much, as this specific way that academia can look.
Yeah, I love that. And it builds resilience. And resilience that's also, yeah, as we said, restorative and supportive and generative and...
nourishing.
Yeah, all of those. So get yourself some para-academic activities.
If you want suggestions for para-academic activities, follow us on the social media platform of your choice. Or actually... just talk to Lorraine. Lorraine has lots of ideas for things.
She has a lot of ideas.
In fact, I dare say I could advertise you some ideas.
She could.
Conferences you could go to, perhaps.
Perhaps.
We will shortly be opening calls for papers for events in September in Budapest.
Amazing. And just in general, keep your eye out for submissions for FU Review because... surely there will be an issue 9.
I sure plan for there to be. And in general, keep your eyes open for all sorts of things. You know, read the posters.
Actually read them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're there for a reason.
Yeah. Or yeah, talk to Lorraine. Seriously. That's how I learned a lot. But also, yeah, if you see something that you like, just do it. Like, don't wait. The same for applying, like, a lot of people, I think, were deterred to apply for exchange programs because you have to do them pretty much like from the start of your master's degree. And that can be overwhelming because you have a lot of other stuff to do. But just throw yourself into things. And again, don't worry so much about the outcome. Just try stuff. And suddenly you're going to be this far into doing yet another interview. Surprise! So, yeah, you never...
And it's a wonderful thing to be able to be that far into doing another interview.
Yeah, 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 that far in. I'm excited.
You're doing
I'm
great.
Almost there, yeah. Where? We'll
Mexico.
Find out. Yeah. So yeah, just try your hand at stuff. You don't need to go through an organization. You can just try things on your own. Like, right. I'm doing some unofficial research. What does that even really mean? We'll find out.
You rarely need permission to do anything you want.
Yeah, honestly. Just make it, and then you can say that you're doing unofficial research.
Right. Independent.
Independent. Independent is better.
Yes.
Independent. See, this is what Lorraine's there for. Unofficial. I read that on my CV.
make sure you show me your CV
before I send it. Anyway, I think that wraps it up.
Yes. Have you been reading anything this
Have
week?
I been reading anything?
Other than what we talked about in the last episode.
You know, I normally am, like, reading various things. I have a few books that I'm about to start, but I haven't started them yet. One of them is Ocean Vuong's. I think it's On Earth Where Briefly Gorgeous, as it's called. I read his anthology.
An enthralling anthology.
Yeah, exactly. That's what an anthology is.
I love that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, can we make some sort of series of...
Just words that we're patenting?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, getting rights over. Yeah, definitely. Make people pay us every time that they accidentally misspeak and say enthrology, is that what it was?
Yes.
But anyway... And it was very good, so I'm excited to read that. These are my trip books. I'm also going to start the second book in the series by Elena Ferrante. Have you heard of her? She's, I guess they're the Neapolitan novels. They're about this, like, I think they take place in maybe the 1950s, and they're about this, this female friendship that, like, spans over their lifetime. And they're from this kind of, like, rough working class neighborhood in Napoli, and it tracks, like, their whole life, and each book is like kind of a stage in their lives. So I read the first one and I loved it, and I have that to read. And also the last one is to pick up with Valeria Luiselli is her essay called Tell Me How It Ends, and it's based on interviews that she did working as a translator for immigration court with children. And this is a topic that is very important to me, so I'm looking forward to also reading that. But yeah, those are my we'll see. Sometimes I don't read like anything when I travel, but sometimes I read a lot. I just can't say.
Do you have a kind of like a specific kind of book that you like to read while you're traveling?
I think for me, it can't be like too dense, you know, if I'm really going to be like reading it in kind of like a space of distraction and in an airport, for example, or on the airplane. Mm-hmm. So not so much a specific genre, but generally like a certain level of like it needs to be not too dense, but also engaging and stimulating mentally enough. I don't like stupid novels. Just in general. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Extremely vague. But yeah, so it needs to be like the right balance between something that's like engaging and stimulating intellectually or mentally, while also not being like so difficult to, that it requires so much focus. But I'm not really specific. Do you have a specific, something more specific than that?
I love reading thrillers when I'm traveling.
Oh really? I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, and actually specifically what I like is listening to thrillers on audiobook.
Oh, that's probably nice.
When I'm like in an airport waiting for the gate to open, on the plane. And the reason I think I like it so much is because it keeps me very like engaged in the fact that I'm listening to this story, and therefore I'm not paying attention to how much I hate traveling.
I was gonna say that maybe like I'm really interested in the idea of like when you have like a nervous system response, how you can like re-prescribe the meaning of why to something else. So like you're probably, at least in my case, I'm a pretty like anxious, intense flying and those moments that you're just describing, but if you can be like, it's because I'm listening to this thriller that I'm feeling like kind of like on pins and needles a little bit, and like maybe a bit anxious rather than like I'm involved in this like very chaotic and kind of overwhelming and stressful experience that I'm actually living.
Exactly. And it makes the time go so much faster because you're like so on edge.
That's a really good idea. Yeah. It's a really good coping mechanism.
Last time I was on a plane, I was listening to the Amityville Horror, which is like...
It's basically how I just feel flying.
Exactly. So, so perfect. Highly amazing. Recommend.
That's a really good idea. Maybe I'll try to do that.
But this is not what I was reading. I haven't... been traveling recently, so I haven't had occasion to listen to a thriller. The book that I recently completed, other than The Testaments, which I talked about last episode, is in a way para-academic, because it has become apparent to me that I am making a significant part of my academic trajectory into being about Jewish studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I know startlingly little about anything from like before 1800,
mm-hmm.
In terms of Jewish history. And specifically, it became clear to me that I know very little about the period right around the year 0 AD,
mm-hmm.
which was in fact a fairly significant political moment. And so, in the interest of learning more about ancient Jewish history, I did the obvious thing, which was to read a book about Jesus.
Yeah.
And about the historical figure mm-hmm. of Jesus of Nazareth as a representative of political struggle in yeah. Roman-occupied first-century Palestine.
Yeah, I think that sounds really, really interesting because, yeah, I'm definitely interested in that, like, perspective of understanding. Because it's interesting how, like, because that is the thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And, like, but it's interesting how, like, this historical event that, like, so many people know about is told through this, like, completely other... I don't know what the adjective I want to use is, like, almost, like, more mystical
mm-hmm.
or, like... You know, like we know these things that it was, yeah, like Roman occupied Palestine, but like, I feel like that was so said so succinctly, but like it's often so enshrouded in this like other more central kind of telling of the story that's mm-hmm. more focused on the mystical.
It's really hard to keep in my head as I read that this is a time that we actually have like really good documentation about. This isn't some like... so far in the past that everything is kind of vague. Like, we know exactly what was happening in
yeah.
Palestine and Roman-occupied territory at this time. It's, like, it's not hard.
Yeah.
And yet, because of the mystical veil over it...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's,
yeah.
like, this impression that we shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah, that... Yeah,
that, it's not, like, a thing that... How would we know things, like... what Nazareth was like.
Yeah, and, like, what the meaning was then, as you said, of, like, of Jesus as this kind of political agent.
Exactly.
In the way that you might see Gandhi as, like, a political agent.
Yeah.
That was, like, a person that was killed for a specific reason also within the confines or the context of this other political reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's also, I periodically read something about Jesus or the life of Jesus, and it's always very entertaining to me to realize as I'm reading these things, like, I went to Sunday school as a kid. I went through many years of it, and yet my key point of reference for everything to do with Jesus is the musical Jesus Christ Superstar. 100%.
Amazing.
And if it's not in that, or like the Nativity pageant, if it's not in one of those, I probably don't know it. And all of the things that have to do with, like, the crucifixion, in my mental, like, connection-making, it's all connections to Jesus Christ Superstar. A great
excellent.
Musical.
Excellent. Yeah, you already know, I went to many years, I was raised, like, very, very disciplined, strict Catholic. Fasting, studying, uniforms. Yeah, so I'll leave it at that. yeah, but it is interesting. Like, in a way, I think that so much of it is really de-intellectualized.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, again, like, I studied theology and like up through like till I was 18, you know, like. It wasn't like it was just when I was, like, a little kid and they're telling you, you know, in this certain way. It was, like, you know, and as you say, there's a lot of well-documented things and, like, understanding the church as this entity of power
mm-hmm.
and understanding these events within the context of real political history is, like, it's interesting how much there can be this kind of gap between that and, as we've said, sort of, like, the mystical kind of really much more... heavily emphasized religious meanings
mm-hmm.
of the same events. So that's cool. I commend you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's all I have to say.
I feel like this was a very wholesome episode.
It's a very wholesome episode. I don't think that we swore at all. I might have sworn once. Not that we were really swearing. it's like the least of the concerns, really.
Yeah. I think we got all of our chaotic energy out in the previous one. All of our hot takes.
Yeah. We even in both of them, we were pretty tame, though, to be honest. Like, compared to some of the other places that we've gone in the past, like...
I mean, we've gone to some places in the
past. We've gone to some places. And then there's all the things that we bleeped out.
Oh, too. Boy.
Like,
and all the things we say when the recording isn't on.
Yeah. Or when we warn each other not to...
Right.
Not to go there kind of thing. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
So yeah. Thank you, dear listener, for joining us for...
This wholesome... You could show this to your grandma.
I could. I've told you, right, about my...
Yeah, it's a good story.
It's a great story.
Yeah, I think that's in one of the episodes, actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I just keep repeating the same story.
It's a good story. It's a good story. It's very cute.
You have to listen to all the other episodes.
You have to listen to the other episodes to find out what she's talking about.
Could be anything.
Could be anything.
What have I told my grandma?
Yeah, what has Lauren told her grandma? You can, if you pay us €5 through our Patreon, you could also just text us on the Cope podcast account. I mean, message us and we'll tell you, but only if you pay us €5 on our Patreon account.
Sounds fair.
Yeah.
Speaking of.
Yeah.
Follow us on Instagram. This is the social media platform of your choice.
Yeah, of your choice.
But you can also post about us on any other social media platform.
Anywhere at all.
Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn.
On the side of a U-Bahn car.
Ooh, yes.
That's my favorite social media platform. Yeah. Please.
If you enjoyed this episode, which I'm sure you did, rate it highly on your podcast listening platform. Sign up for our Patreon.
And sign up for Lorraine's 10-day thesis writing course. It's still happening. We're still advertising, but... Soon, all the spots will be filled.
Yes, so get them while you can. As an advertising person, I strongly recommend...
We'll negotiate your price.
Discount for everyone who comes in through the podcast.
Yeah, as opposed to all the other places that are advertising this.
Hey, you don't know where else I'm advertising this, really.
That is true, I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah, unbeknownst to me.
We're going to get a very specific demographic.
They're going to be into all the corporal punishment.
Yeah, some people are there for the thesis. Some people are there for the corporal punishment. Who can say?
The fear. Yeah, it's going to be a good mix. A rousing group of of scholars.
And para-academics.
Yeah, para-academic scholars. Anyway, see you there. I'll be live camming the whole thing.
You will be.